ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Science.
Well, joining us for a look at science topics this week is the one and only Charlie Lineweaver. Charlie, good evening to you.
Good evening, Earthling.
Well, I'm personally a bit disappointed, but the interstellar comet 3031 Atlas is not an alien spacecraft. Sad.
Well, my job is to convince you that the wonder of science and cometary astronomy is even better than the prospect of advanced aliens that will come and kill you.
Yeah, I don't want aliens here.
I know that, so why would you even want, why would you even have fun speculating about this? No, the reason why this is in the news is I have a colleague, Avi Loeb, who kind of misinterprets these things and gets the population excited, and conspiracy theorists are all over the place. Oh, this alien! Oh, no. And it's a wonderful comet. This is only the third extrasolar comet that we've ever detected. So to put this in perspective, about 20 years ago, we found for the first time planets orbiting other stars, right? But when these planetary systems form, they just, it's a gravitational chaotic nightmare, and they spew out things all over the galaxy. Our system did that 4.5 billion years ago. Every planetary system that forms does that too. It just spews out stuff. But up until a few years ago, we haven't been able to detect any of that spewing material. But then we found a couple of years ago Oumuamua, and then Borisov, and now for the third time we have detected a very large, about 1 kilometer diameter, interstellar object. And we know it's interstellar because it's just zooming through the solar system. It's not bound to the sun like every other thing and every other comet we know. So it's exciting because it's new, it's large, and we're looking at what's giving off the tail and the comets and all kinds of interesting features because it came from a solar system that was not based on our sun. All the other comets in our solar system came from the material that was forming the sun. So this comet came from a bunch of material that's different. For example, it had only half the iron or nickel or oxygen, for example. And it also came from far away from the host star, not, you know, 1 AU or 2 AU like, you know, Venus and Earth and Mars, but something like 10 AU beyond Jupiter's orbit. And so that's where it's more easy to get strewn and spewed
out.
So
what do you reckon the most amazing thing is? That it's very like comets in our solar system, or it's very unlike comets in our solar system?
Well, I think it's kind of the variation that you'd expect from a comet that comes from another star system. Right. Because we look at other stars and we know kind of how different they are from our star. And so this pretty much fits the bill of what you'd expect from a comet from such a different planetary system. You know, but you know, there's a guy named Mick West. And the reason I'm kind of frustrated about this because one of my favorite comedians, Bill Maher, talked about this new film called The Age of Disclosure, which is just the most incredible bunch of baloney about government officials saying, oh, I've seen these aliens and I've seen – it's just – there's a guy named Mick West who's a scientist and an IT specialist, and he's bought the equipment with which a lot of these UFO videos have been made, and he analyzed them in a systematic, what I would call a scientific way, and he kind of like – his results were – he could explain half of them by, hey, it's a shadow or a reflection of the – you know, the night vision goggles were not adjusted, blah, 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 blah. But half of them, he just couldn't say anything about it because they're so blurry and just vague. So that's what I call a scientific analysis. But I've never heard anything like that come out of a government official or a pilot or some CIA operative. And that's what the whole film, this new film, is full of, these blah, 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 these guys who are not scientists talking about an issue that I think is very scientific, very, very interesting, but it's just baloney. And I said, God, give me a scientist, please.
Hey, Charlie, moving on.
Don't move on. This is such dumb.
Before you blow a fuse here, tell me about they've discovered some more subspecies of Denisovans. Now, these were ancient upright creatures who bred with Homo erectus before erectus went extinct.
Well,
these are all our predecessors, aren't they?
Yeah, yes, but don't say that thing about Homo erectus too loudly, because right now it's politically correct to call evidence of Homo erectus DNA as super archaic or a species X. They don't know that for a fact because we don't have Homo erectus DNA. Homo erectus went extinct about 125,000 years ago.
Oh, okay, but we don't have anything from them. But we do have Denisovans. Apparently, it's the second piece of DNA we've ever recovered about Denisovans.
Well, that's Denisovans, but I'm talking now about Homo erectus.
Yeah.
You know, part of what you said was, oh, they had sex with Homo erectus. And there's a lot of evidence for that, but people are so wary and so careful. And the fact that we don't have Homo erectus DNA. We have never, although we have lots and lots of fossils. You know, Java Man, for example, or Solo Man, they're fossils, but we have not been able to extract DNA from them because they're significantly older. They went extinct about 100,000 years. But I'm sure in the next year, two, three, they're going to tell us, we have a DNA sample, we have genome from Homo erectus. And but right now, what they have is, it's interesting, you know, this is the second Denisovan DNA they have. And the first one was a woman 65,000 years ago. This one was a man about 200,000 years ago, much, much earlier. And because they have two, and they can look carefully at this Denisovan DNA, they can say, hey, this, and compare it to Neanderthals, they now can say, oh, wait a minute, there weren't just one group of Denisovans. There are really three pretty separate groups. And based on that, they can say, oh, look at this. For example, the Australian Aborigines and Melanesian population have a much larger fraction of one type of Denisovan. But East Asians and South Asians have another type of Denisovan. And then Indians, where's the other? Oh, the other is in West Asia and, Middle East. Mm-hmm. So there's some Denisovan. Anyways, we're finding out a lot about the details because you can imagine we're talking about 100,000 years ago. All of modern human history is only 10,000 years, and this is at least 10 times longer. And if you're interested in this, and I think I wish you were, I wish everybody is, there's a guy named David Reich at Harvard who's been finding out all kinds of things. They dig up skeletons that are, 1,000 years, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, and he's interested in the, 10,000, 20,000, 40,000 year period. But Svante Paabo, the guy who taught him what he knows, he's interested in the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. So if you're interested in this topic, you can do no better than looking at Svante Paabo's work. He's at Leipzig, and David Reich, he's at Harvard.
Okay. Now, they've dug up an old bloke from China. He was buried with pomp and ceremony. They weren't so much interested in him. He's 2,200 years old, this bloke, so well and truly dead. But he was buried in a wooden coffin, and the wood of the coffin has revealed some interesting things.
Yeah, so let's move from the DNA data analysis of our ancestors to the much more recent but a completely different technique using dendrochronology, using tree rings to figure out what was the climate like 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. You can do this as long as you have a piece of wood that's that old. And recently they found a whole trove of wooden coffins in Western China from which they are, I guess, renewing the hope of all dendrochronologists to take their genealogy, their trees, their dating back further and further and further. And why that's so important is because we would love to know what the climate on Earth was like 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. And that's what this dendrochronology can do. And that's why this new trove of wooden coffins is so important. So, Phil, when you die, are you going to be buried in a wooden coffin?
No.
Because if you are, you might contribute to future dendrochronology.
I wouldn't waste good timber on that.
Okay. Well, you can contribute to future science. Think of it as a fundamental investment in future science.
Yeah. All right. Now, what about this? Living underwater doesn't appeal to me. But there's good science to be done underwater because we really don't know much about the deep oceans. We know more about what's going on the surface of Mars than we do in the deep ocean. But last week in Miami, there's been a prototype of a long-term habitat unveiled for living underwater. It's size of a container, but you can go in there. At the moment, you go down there for a few hours at most, but with this thing, you could live there for months.
Yeah, this is a whole new – this is a company called Deep.com, and their mission statement, as they say, is to make mankind aquatic.
Wrong. We came out of the water onto land. We don't want to go back.
We do. We want to go everywhere. We want to go everywhere that our brain can take us. And that's what brains are doing. They're creating this environment called a habitat. It's about as big as a container. It's meant for a crew of four. And right now it can only go down to about 50 feet. 50 meters. 50 meters, sorry. Yes, come on, Charlie. It goes out 50 meters, and then you live there. And it reminds me a little bit of the high luxury, very small international space stations that are being created by, you know, hotel companies.
There'd be no view, would there, because it's dark outside.
Oh, no, it's only 50 meters down, so it's still enough light. The photo zone of the ocean goes down to 100 meters or so.
Okay. Right.
So, but if you want to go down deep, then you have your own lights. You have your, you know, they have batteries down there, and they'll show, shine. Oh, look at that, look at that. So people have not lived underneath the water.
They go in
submarines. I don't understand why they don't take one of these submarines. Maybe it's just
in a nuclear submarine. You disappear under the water for months at a time.
Yeah, but you're not doing science there. You're not looking out the window and saying, "Oh, look at that fish! Look at that fish!" You're kind of like saying, "Oh, keep our communication with Washington open so we can bomb somebody in the future." But no. So anyway, we're going to figure out more about the ocean by living there, just like you live.
Where do you reckon they should set up shop first?
Charlie? Well, the first, this is a prototype. So what they're setting up is at a dockside in Miami. So they're just putting it a little bit into the water and making sure all the systems work. Because this is it's like putting a hotel underwater. It's not like a submarine where everything is very, very basic.
Mind you, 50 meters, I think, is a bit, you know, I suppose this is the beginning, isn't it? I mean, that's not very deep.
Well, you don't need, for example, let's say you were interested in dolphin behavior.
Yeah.
And right now, people who are interested in dolphin behavior go out in a boat, put on 1 hour worth of oxygen, and then float around with the dolphins and then come back up. And then that's it. They visit their relatives for only 1 hour a day or something. But if you put one of these habitats there, you'd have four divers. They'd take turns going out, and they'd look out the windows and see, oh, that's the one I was looking at just before. So it's a way of exploring by being in the environment. It's much like what Jane Goodall did. You know, she, instead of just speculating about zoo chimpanzees, she went there and sat in the jungle for a long, 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 long time, and then they got habituated, and then finally she was able to make all kinds of discoveries, like tool use.
Yeah, that's true.
And maybe you could do that with dolphins. I'm sure for example, if you're interested in talking to dolphins, you have to have all kinds of, you like to see what's going on and then hear and then correlate the sounds with the behavior and say, that's what this means. Like, you know, that's the type of thing you could discover.
All righty. Now, a couple of things before you go. How about this three-legged lion in Uganda?
Yeah, I saw the three-legged lion. There's a wonderful picture of this three-legged lion. He really only has three legs.
Yeah.
And it was his poor leg. His name's Jacob, and he lost it in a poacher's snare a few years ago. They said, oh, this guy's toast. He's not going to be able to live because, you know, they're not very good at sharing, I guess, in lion communities.
No.
But this guy, Jacob, he lived and lived and lived. He said, why is he living? And he first showed up because they had a drone and they saw two lions swimming a 1.5 kilometer river. And they said, whoa, this is a world's record. And it was crocodiles all over the place. Anyway, they swam across and they said, oh, it's probably getting mates or something over there. But they followed this lion. They kind of tagged it. And then they saw with a infrared nighttime, a thermal camera on a drone, they saw that it wasn't hunting anymore like a normal lion, but it was hunting like a leopard. It would ambush. It would hide away in some bush and then wait until something got very, very close and then pounce on it like leopards do. And so the idea is, wow, this lion is adapting to having three legs by becoming a leopard. And they didn't know that their behavior, I guess, was so flexible.
Yeah, yeah. I love this one. How about the Swedish musician has taught an octopus to play the piano? Now, I'm not surprised because I've done stories about octopuses before. They are very intelligent creatures.
With Godfrey Smith.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
That very man, exactly. But is this fair dinkum?
Well, I would say it's semi-fair dinkum because he documents this. He's more of a YouTuber than a scientist, but he touches semi-scientific topics. And can you teach an octopus to play the piano?
Yeah.
It's an interesting goal. And so he went and got an octopus, and then he had to keep it alive, and then he had a tank, and then he had to figure out how to feed it, and then you know how you give a dog rewards for doing something you want? Well, that's what he was doing with an octopus. Every time the octopus did a behavior he liked, he would give it a reward and then positive reinforcement. But then he had to figure out because octopi arms, you know, you could, if he ever was a good piano, I mean, you could play eight pianos or something. Anyway, so what happened was he figured out these octopi, although they can pull with their tentacles, they're really bad at pushing.
Okay.
So what he did was attach a little pole to all the keys of a piano so to to press down, the octopus would pull it. Yeah. So that was an interesting scientific invention there. And so then he would positively reinforce the octopus. I'm not sure if the octopus could hear the sounds they were playing. Maybe they could. I didn't look at it that carefully. Uh-huh. But it was playing, and he taught the octopus to play Baby Shark.
Oh, no.
It's a really crude version of it. Don't raise your anticipation too high. But it was an interesting attempt to teach piano playing to octopi. And I think there's a big future in this. I think that maybe with a little bit more care, he could teach it to play something that was interesting.
You know what, Charlie? There's a sucker born every minute. See ya.
All right, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.